This program is brought to you by PrideNZ.com.
I joined the police in January 1961 as a cadet, graduated from the police college at Trentham in August 1962, and spent the rest of my career in the police in the Wellington area, and mainly as a qualified detective in the Wellington CIB. Now, in the CIB, the staff are separated off into various squads, the drug squad and the car squad and the burglary squad and so on and so forth. And there was a vice squad, albeit there was only two of us on the squad, a detective sergeant and myself as his detective. And I didn't ask to be put on it. You don't ask to get put on any particular squad. From time to time, the bosses get together and decide that, well, Trevor's been this long on X squad, so it's time we gave him a bit of experience in some other area of policing. And it just happened that at some stage in my career, they decided that I would stop doing what I was doing, which I think was the car squad, and that they would put me on the vice squad. Now, I had no problem with that. It was just another squad that you did some work on.
What did the vice squad police?
Well, it's interesting because particularly in America, it's often called the morals squad, which is a very actually descriptive term. Because vice is a problem of, well, not a problem, though some governments see it as a problem and some societies see it as a problem. But vice is a matter of morality. What can be a crime in some countries of the world may not be a crime in others. And in fact, we've had that phenomena here in New Zealand just in my very short lifetime. Because there are now no vice squads in any police district anywhere in New Zealand, simply because our laws relating to morality, in other words, relating to vice, have completely changed. But going back to the 60s and 70s and into the 80s, we did have a number of laws which endeavoured to control the morality of the nation. We had laws, and we may still have laws, making bookmaking illegal. Illegal gambling on racehorses, because the government wanted everyone to gamble through the TAB and thereby get the tax and so on and so forth. And there's often a monetary background to these laws. Prostitution, whilst prostitution itself per se was not illegal, it was illegal for someone to importune someone on a public street, and it was also an offence to live off the earnings of prostitution. It was also an offence to keep a brothel and various other offences relating to brothel keeping and sexual crimes. That, though I'm not talking about rape or any other kind of violent sexual offending, that was handled by another squad in the CIB. Pornography. The vice squad would enforce the laws relating to pornography. And there was an Indecent Publications Act. There was an Indecent Publications Tribunal. And certainly in my day, that related mainly to printed material videotapes. We didn't have DVDs in those days. And in fact, when I first went onto the vice squad, the VCR and the video cassette had not quite been invented yet. So I can remember we seized and had a lot to do with little small rolls of silent 8mm coloured film. So there was indecent publications, prostitution and similar crimes relating to that, and illegal gambling. They were most probably the three areas of interest to the vice squad. And bearing in mind, and you know, one of the reasons why we're talking today, is because sexual acts between consenting males was still a crime. We hadn't had that liberal expansion of the law to make that illegal. So we would look at that aspect of the law as well in terms of our investigations.
So when you're saying sex between males, are you referring to things like patrolling the beats or things
well, no,
like that?
No, what I'm talking about is that in those days, in the late 1960s and into the 70s when I was on the vice squad, it was an offence for a male of irrespective of age to, quote, indecently assault another male, even though it may have been done consensually. Now, we didn't necessarily pay a great deal of attention to that kind of law, except that in those days, there were quite a few what were incorrectly called transvestites, but which were adult males who would dress in female clothing. And again, a complication. In those days, a male could not in law be a prostitute. Okay? So you would have the phenomena of males dressed as females walking the streets of Wellington, Vivian Street, for example, but they weren't committing an offence because they weren't a prostitute. Had they been a female in female clothing, or even a female in male clothing, walking the streets and touting for business, they would be committing an offence. But males weren't. But nevertheless, a number of, quote, straight, unquote, straight males would see these individuals and assume that they were a female. And so they would enter in some conversation and go around the corner or into someone's house or whatever. Now, we became involved in investigating those activities, firstly, because there was a crime being committed, the crime of one male indecently assaulting another male, albeit there was consent involved. But that was consent obtained to some degree by fraud, because the guileless member of the public who thought he was engaging in some sexual relationship with a female was in actual fact engaging in a sexual relationship with a male. So there was that, shall we say, fraudulent aspect involved there, which is why we tended to, I wouldn't exactly say concentrate, but if we came across that kind of offence happening, or it would be drawn to our attention, then we would investigate. So we had this element of fraud involved in a importuning of members of the public by men dressed as women who were not prostitutes because of the law, but were committing a criminal offence because they were a male and decently assaulting another male.
So did you find that people would come to you and complain that this had happened to them? Or is it just when you discovered it by accident? Or?
Sometimes we would discover it by accident, and sometimes we would get complaints. We would sometimes get complaints from members of the public who perhaps had shops or retail businesses, the kinds of things that we're still finding now are happening in New Zealand because the prostitution laws have changed. It's now left over to local authorities. And, you know, we've got the phenomena down in Christchurch where the prostitutes used to congregate in certain streets in the CBD no longer can because they're red zone, so they're going out to the suburbs and they're upsetting the residents in the suburbs. So that kind of antagonism towards the sex industry existed during my time, but for different reasons, and it still exists today because people find it antisocial and, you know, the flow-on effects of the behaviour. So we wouldn't patrol what you might call the beats, because the beats, as I understand it from a male homosexual point of view, would be where adult male homosexuals would go to establish a relationship, fleeting or permanent, with another male. And everybody knew that it was a male and a male. But as I say, we would become interested in the aspect of a male dressed as a female because there was the fraudulent aspect of it, plus it was still a crime.
So when you saw street workers, did you actively discourage them from being on the street? How did that work?
Well, it was an interesting situation because we had no power to say get off the street, because merely being on the street because they were a male and males could not be prostitutes meant they were not committing an offence. So, I mean, we would talk to them. They knew who we knew who they were. They knew we knew what they were doing. And if we hove into view, they would, you know, very quickly disappear until we hove out of view, and then they'd be back on the corner again. So it was not exactly a losing battle, but at least we would endeavour to keep them off the streets because we knew that sooner or later there was going to be some disgruntled adult males out there who the next day might be coming down to the vice squad or getting their lawyer to ring us up to complain about what had happened. And they'd feel that they'd been defrauded. They thought they were going to have some kind of sexual encounter with an adult female, but it turns out they're having a sexual encounter with an adult male.
But if it was illegal for women to be prostitutes, surely in the general public they would know that if they saw somebody on the street, it wasn't going to be a woman.
Oh, no, not necessarily. The fact that it was only females could be prostitutes wasn't widely known amongst the general public. In fact, I would venture to say that very few of the men in the street would have known that. I'm just trying to think of a corollary in regard to the law. But, I mean, there's just many aspects of the law that the layperson just doesn't know about. And it's only when you start getting into having to administer the law, such as the vice squad in prostitution. You know, if a woman was standing on the street and, you know, she appeared for all intents and purposes to be a prostitute, and we went up and spoke to her, she'd very quickly, you know, vamoose. But if it was a man, they could stand there quite brazenly almost. But the punter, as the Poms like to call them, to the punter, that person was, for all intents and purposes, a female, a prostitute available for hire.
Can you describe for me the internal attitudes in the police force around the 1970s towards transgender, gay, lesbian people?
Not a lot of transgender people around in those days, to start with, genuinely transgender. The first, I was just trying to think of what her business name was, and it may come to me. But in fact, a transgender individual featured in a major court case that I was involved in that actually was instrumental in reversing the law, or opening the law, whichever way you want to look at it, that in effect said, yes, a man can be a prostitute. And that was a case that we had with Carmen. It's been well reported on, and I know Carmen and knew extremely well, and I know she won't mind me talking about this. But we had an investigation where we believed Carmen was quite clearly keeping a brothel and or living on the earnings of a prostitution and committing various crimes under the Crimes Act and operating out of her coffee bar in Vivian Street. So we got an undercover agent to come up from down south, an elderly police officer, and he went in there and spoke to Carmen, introduced himself to Carmen and had a chat to Carmen, and no sooner had he spoken to her, and he had a bit of a gift for the gab, as did Carmen. She'd arranged for him with a young lady who was on the premises to go off to his hotel room, which we'd arranged. So he left with this woman, went to the hotel room, we followed, and gave him X amount of time to get part the way into the operation. Undercover agents, of course, never ever engaged in any sexual contact with any of these women. And it transpired that this woman, and I use those words in quotation marks, was not a woman. He/she was transgender. And it transpired that he had been born a male baby boy, for all intents and purposes a young boy. But later in life, he had gone overseas and had had a full physical sex change operation, breast implants, the whole thing. And when we burst into the hotel room, I remember seeing him standing naked beside the bed. And he sure looked, for all intents and purposes, like a female. And it was only when we were back at the vice squad office interviewing him about what had happened between him and the undercover agent and him and Carmen that we discovered that he was, although the word transgender then hadn't been sort of invented, if you will, he was, for all intents and purposes, a male. Genetically he was, and biologically he was. So that put us in a bit of a bind, because as he had been born a male and was, for all intents and purposes, biologically a male, then he couldn't be a prostitute. So therefore, how were we going to convict Carmen from running a brothel or living on the earnings of a prostitute? And it became a very, very interesting case. I think the Chief Justice heard it at the time. Roy Stacey defended Carmen, and a lot of medical evidence had to be given by both the Crown and the defence for each side to say why this person either was or was not a male or a female. And the judge, of course, had to leave it to the jury to decide whether they were going to convict Carmen and this, I still can't think of his name. Anyway, the upshot of it was that they did find both Carmen and this chap guilty of the offences of living off the earnings of prostitution, etc., etc., which in effect said, yes, a man can be a prostitute under New Zealand law. It's what they call case law. It's not actually written in statute. You can't go and pull a book down and say, you know, this is an offence. But by case law, it established the fact that, yes, a man could be a prostitute under New Zealand law. So that was, that would have been sort of the first notable instance that I would have had any dealings with a genuine transgender person. And that would have been, I suspect, about 1971 or 72. You see, Carmen was, for all intents and purposes, always a guy. You know, there was no doubt in anybody's mind that she was, underneath her flamboyancy, that she was a guy. Whereas this individual...
Was it Carol De Winter?
Was it Carol? Can't think. She had her naked photographs in Truth, I remember. May have been, I'm not certain. I just can't remember at the moment. But, yeah, so that seemed a bit of a benchmark. But as I say, in terms of genuine transgender people, she would be one of the very first that I certainly came across on Vice. There were others that came along in years gone by. But... they were, by and large, what we misnamed as transvestites, i.e. just men dressed in women's clothing. People like Carol, if it was Carol. I would never call Carmen a transgender, because I'm pretty certain whilst she had breast implants, from the point of view of physical operation, she never went any further than that. I'm pretty certain, and I think she said so herself. So it was mainly a mixture of actual prostitutes, women, the occasional transgender, such as Carol, who you mentioned, and then people like Carmen, who were still overtly a male. But I suppose, depending on how many sheets to the wind you were, you know, you could be confused for thinking that she wasn't a male and that she was a female. But, I mean, we were dealing with these, as I say, misnamed transvestites quite a lot. And it never ceased to surprise me how a presumably straight individual could importune one of these transvestites and not realize that they were dealing with a man. Because, you know, some of them were very big boys. And in their garb, they were almost caricatures of females. You know, but I suppose that's because I was dealing with them all the time and talking with them and interacting with them and that sort of thing. It became very obvious to me that they were males. But I suppose if you're staggering out of the hotel at, 10 o'clock at night and you saw someone dressed in a skirt across the road, you know, the brain says, hey, that's a girl. But just going on to you talking about the beats in terms of male homosexuals, you know, trawling, if you'll excuse the phrase, for other males of a like inclination, we had pretty much enough to do without concentrating or investigating that kind of thing a lot. It was certainly crimes being committed, male indecently assaulting another male, albeit with consent. But unless we got a specific complaint, I remember there used to be some, in fact there still are, though they've been refurbished, men's toilets round at Lyle Bay, and they were apparently a favourite meeting spot. And from time to time, we might get a complaint from a straight male who had gone to use the toilets and had possibly been importuned, or there was a male homosexual hanging around, clearly wanting to meet up with someone for sexual activities, and that would be offensive to the straight guy, so they might complain to us. But we certainly never particularly targeted the beats and that sort of thing, and really only investigated activities of straight males on beats when we got a complaint. As I say, with all the other Vice Squad things, we had enough to do.
You've mentioned the word importuned a number of times. Can you tell me what that means?
Oh, importune means soliciting. In other words, if I was a male homosexual and I wanted to see if I could hook up with someone, then I would perhaps go to the toilets out at Lyle Bay or the ones that used to be in town, the infamous ones where Colin Moyle got caught, so to speak. I would go there and I might stand at the urinal for just far too long, just waiting to see if someone was going to come in. And if some guy came in, and even whether he... made any recognition or any sign or gave any idea that he was looking for contact, the other person would, you know, start talking to them, perhaps introduce some sexual overtones to the conversation and that sort of thing. So you're importuning, soliciting, same sort of thing.
Mm. I'm just wondering if we can go back to maybe some of the attitudes within the police about transvestites. Can you recall, were there any words that were used to describe them, or how were they treated? Were they treated with respect, or were they kind of looked down on? Or
wouldn't say they were treated with respect, but then again, I wouldn't. Difficult to. I'm just trying to think of the right words there. They were, as I say, they were misnamed from the whoever decided to call them transvestites. I don't know. That's just something that grew up in society. No, it wasn't just a police jargon. It was a word that was widely used in the media. And the word gay, I suppose, hadn't quite come into common usage then in terms of a male homosexual who looked like a male, didn't dress in female clothing. I mean, we would arrest transvestites. We'd perhaps come across them in a car with somebody, perhaps masturbating them or doing some kind of a sexual act. So we could then arrest them for being a male and decently assaulting another male, albeit it was done with consent. So we would arrest them, put them in the car, take them down to the police station, interview them, get a statement from them, and keep them in the cells overnight. In the morning, they'd be given breakfast. We had what was called lineup, where the prisoners kept in overnight would be individually brought into a room, and just questioned as to what their name was, who they were, why they were there. And behind a big sheet of one-way glass, there'd be the rest of the CIB and other staff on, just so they could get to see who these people were. But no, I wouldn't say they were treated in any other special or different way. They were just another criminal. I mean, they were looked upon as having committed a criminal offence. So they just sort of were processed through the court and through the police cells. I certainly don't have any recollection or even of hearing any sort of rumours of transvestites or transgender people being treated in any other way other than that. They're a human being, but they're a crook. They're a crim, so we've got to get them through the process and before the court.
Were they segregated in any way in the police cells?
No, down at Central we had a pretty big double row of ground floor, first floor row of cells. I would have think there would have been 7, 8, 12. We could have had upwards of 16 or 20 cells. Bearing in mind they weren't there for very long. If they'd been arrested at say around midnight or 1 o'clock in the morning, they were only there from that point on until they went to court at 9:30. They'd get bailed at court, so they'd only be in the station for about 8 hours. I would suspect that, but bearing in mind, you see, when a detective arrests someone and takes them down to what's called the watch house, it's the watch house keeper who's a uniform branch constable who's in charge of all the prisoners and in charge of the cell block. And it would be that officer who would decide into which cell any particular prisoner goes. And I would think, as a matter of course, they would most probably segregate transvestites. I mean, if there's two or three of them arrested in one night, they might put them all in one cell together, just for company, for no other reason. But I doubt that they would, in fact, put them in a cell with another criminal, just because you didn't do that anyway. Offenders were normally segregated, particularly if they were arrested in connection with the same thing.
So did many of those kind of raids happen on brothels?
Oh, we would raid brothels, I was going to say, on demand. There were certainly quite a few of them operating in Wellington, and we would get information from time to time, usually from neighbours. They'd say, oh, they'd ring up, you know, or they'd get someone to come in and tell us that, you know, such and such a place is being run as a brothel. So we would carry out some surveillance on the place to see whether or not there was, in fact, a brothel being run there. Were the females only living in the house? How big a house was it? What number of bedrooms were there? Who was the landlord? Could he be approached? How would people get up there? How would they get back? That sort of thing. And you would soon work out that, oh, yeah, you know, from 8 o'clock at night, there's a continual stream of taxis going from the, you know, from the cab rank in Courtney Place just down from, I forget the name of the coffee bar in Marjorie Bank Street, which was frequented by Japanese seamen. And they would go to certain houses in Wellington. And it didn't take us long to work out where. So we'd do some surveillance, get sufficient evidence, get a search warrant, wait until there were, you know, three or four males inside the house and crash bang the front door. So, yeah, quite simple. And as I say, we would just do that sort of on demand, so to speak. You know, we might develop the case ourselves because of something that we'd seen. You know, just driving around, thinking, oh, I saw that cab at that house the other day, and now it's back at the house on the time of night, or the same people coming and going, that sort of thing. We'd sometimes develop them ourselves, sometimes we get some information from the public.
How did you feel enforcing these kind of morality laws?
Interesting question. I didn't feel anything in particular because it was a law that they were breaking. And I'm just trying to think of a bit of a corollary in regard to other laws. Take bookmaking. Now, we would often work on a Saturday afternoon because that's when bookmakers work. And we would go and kick in the doorways of shops because the guy was back at his work. Instead of running his book from home, he'd run it from the back of his shop or houses and what have you. Now, I don't gamble. I'm not interested in horse racing, anything like that at all. But it didn't take me long to do a bit of crash banging of doors, to realise that bookmakers were actually providing a service that is substantial, or not necessarily substantial, that a sizable percentage of the population actually wanted. Else they wouldn't be in business. And I just thought about that and thought that was an interesting thing to sort of way of looking at it. And it seemed to me that the state should have been providing some kind of a way to regulate this illegal industry so that it no longer existed and all the tax that was not being paid on those earnings was going into the coffers. So whilst I held this particular view that, gee, the government should be doing something about this, I never expressed it to anyone. It was just a purely personal idea or tenet that I held in my brain. And I still went out there and kicked in doors. It's another morality law, abortion. Now, when I grew up in Hastings, we were a Church of England family. We went to church once a month, Boy Scout, all that kind of carry on. The subject of abortion was never mentioned, of course, because in the 50s and 60s, you didn't talk about those sorts of things. Not deliberately, it was just something that, you know, people didn't talk about. So I joined the police, and during the course of my 18 months as a cadet, and we started looking at all the crimes under the Crimes Act, abortion, unlawful killing of an unborn child, etc., etc. And that's where I first became aware, really, of abortion and how it was done and that sort of thing. So I thought, oh, well, that's the crime, so that's what we do. And I was involved in several abortion investigations when I was in the CIB, not because that was part of the vice squad, because it wasn't. One of the squads was just collectively known as the general squad, and anything that came in that wasn't specifically named for a squad got given to the general squad, and I was on general for quite a while and did a number of abortion investigations when I was on general. One in particular was a taxi driver who would go around doing abortions, and he kept his abortion kit wrapped up in a, I don't know, whatever, in the boot of his taxi, which I didn't think was a very good idea. There were other abortionists who operated outside of Wellington. And I came to the impression, understanding or knowledge, that this was something that shouldn't be a crime, but it is a service, a health service, that the state should provide to the public. But despite holding that view, and it's a view I still hold, I had to go out and enforce that law because that's what I had sworn to do when I put my hand on the Bible and said, you know, blah, 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 when I became a police officer. So And I think that kind of conflict would exist with many, many policemen. Now, of course, and as I mentioned earlier on, abortion's pretty much legal these days. Bookmaking most probably still exists, but not to the degree it used to. We haven't talked a lot about pornography, but I mean, the pornography that we were dealing with in the 60s and 70s, you can now go and rent for a dollar a night down at your local video shop. And that's all changed. And abortion is virtually, a state-provided service now. So all those crimes of morality are no longer crimes. So they've changed. But even if they hadn't changed, I would still hold the view, if I was still in the police, I would still hold the view that the state should be in a position to provide these services because there are people who need them from time to time. And actually, in regard to the abortion thing, you may know the name of Dr. Margaret Sparrow. She's very heavily involved and has been for decades in the legalised abortion movement. And she wrote a book a couple of years ago on the history of abortion in New Zealand. And I spoke to her and went into quite a lot more detail and about the way that I approached the investigation of abortion. It was a crime, so that's what you investigated.
You mentioned before about Carmen, and I'm just wondering, when did you first meet Carmen?
Oh, hard to say. I most probably met or came across Carmen before I actually was transferred onto the vice squad, just because I was a detective in Wellington and she was a figure, someone to get to know in Wellington and that sort of thing. So I don't actually remember that, but I do remember, and I may have related this anecdote to you before, I do remember that when I got transferred from whatever squad I was on onto the vice squad, and my sergeant was a chap by the name of Paul Fitzharris, and he was only about as tall as I was, so we were the sort of two shortest detectives in Wellington. Why they did that, I don't know. And of course, Carmen and many of her friends and associates were quite big people, but that was okay. But the interesting thing was that it didn't take Carmen's associates to become aware that my first name, Trevor, was the same as Carmen's real first name. Now, one thing I quickly learned on the vice squad was that you never ever addressed a transvestite, transgender person by their real name. You found out what their pseudonym was, if you will, and that's how you addressed them because that's how they like to be addressed. So whenever I spoke to Carmen, it was Carmen. Never Trevor. Never ever thought of calling her that. And she always called me Detective Morley or Detective Sergeant Fitzharris. And that was the way we conducted our business. And Paul Fitzharris would say if he was here that Carmen was one of the most pleasant people we ever had to deal with in our vice squad days. But, so here's Detective Trevor Morley walking into Carmen's International Coffee Bar in Vivian Street. And this is not long after I'd been transferred onto the vice squad and people began to know my name. And within a few seconds of walking through that door into the haze and the fog and the fug and the coffee and the smoke and all that sort of thing, you'd hear echoing through the coffee bar, Trevor! And of course, Carmen would turn around and look daggers at whoever she thought had said that because you just didn't call her by that name in front of other people. And she would eventually work out who was calling out, Trevor! And she'd go and she'd stand in front of them and wave her big fat finger under their nose and say, how dare you? And they would look at her with, mock solemnity on their face, deadpan, and say, no, darling, I was talking to Detective Morley. So if you'll excuse the pun, I became the butt of some jokes amongst the transgender and transvestite community. But it was all just part of that fun. But, that night that we arrested Carmen over with that investigation I mentioned before with I think it might have been Carol now, she was pleasant to deal with, no problems. Come with us, Carmen. Yes, of course. You'll ring Mr. Stacey for me, will you? But of course, Carmen, as soon as we get to the station and Roy would come down and, just very pleasant to deal with. Yeah.
So was that quite a regular thing, her being arrested?
Oh, no. We arrested her on that occasion. There was another, I think we might have arrested her twice. And I think it was after the second time that she decided it was time to go to Australia. So I think I could claim some responsibility for terminating her initial career in Wellington. No, as I say, we arrested her that time. There was a second occasion, I think, where a young policeman went upstairs to the rooms above the coffee bar. There might have been a third occasion. I think if there was a third occasion, she was acquitted, or the judge or the jury couldn't agree or whatever, but she could see the writing on the wall. The other thing is that it became extremely well known amongst the police and amongst the public at large that Carmen was, in effect, running a brothel. Now, the question was, if there's a vice squad and there's someone as popular and as public as Carmen running a brothel, how come she ain't being arrested? And, of course, the answer is she's most probably not being arrested because she's paying off the police. So there was no way we were going to let that kind of rumour flourish, because it's in the area of vice that corruption can occur within police departments, and it's happened, you know, overseas. And in fact, the only, just quickly digressing, the only time in my whole 17 years in the police that anyone ever came halfway to trying to bribe me was when I was on the vice squad. And it was a bookmaker that we arrested running a book out of a house in Brooklyn. And we crash banged the front door this Saturday afternoon. And as we ran down the hallway, he ran into the kitchen and picked up a briefcase and threw it out the kitchen window. So we had a young policeman with us to give us a hand. So he went outside and ferreted through the bushes and found the briefcase, brought it in, opened the briefcase, and it was chock-a-block with cash. You couldn't have got another dollar note in there. So this is interesting. We said, "What's that for, Joe?" He said, "Oh, that's for me to pay out on my winnings or my losings on tomorrow, Sunday or Monday before the bank's open." So that's all right. So we got into the car to go back to the vice squad office to lock him up. And he'd incidentally had one previous conviction for bookmaking. And bookmaking was one of those very rare offences whereby for a second or subsequent conviction, you had to go to jail. And he didn't want to go to jail. So we're driving back, and for some reason, Paul Fitzharris was driving. I was sitting in the back behind Paul. On the back seat between me and Joe was the briefcase with the money. And we're driving down Brooklyn Hill Road. And Joe sort of leaned over and sort of gave a nod towards the bag of money. And I said, "Oh, yeah, what?" He said, "Why don't you get the sergeant to slow down at the bottom of Brooklyn Hill and I might just fall out of the car and leave my bag behind." I said, "Oh, that's not a bad idea, Joe." I said, "Hey, Paul," caught Paul's eye in the rearview mirror. "Hey, Paul, do you want to slow down at the bottom of the hill?" He said, "No, what do I want to do that for?" "Well, Joe's just given us the nod on the briefcase here." He said, "Oh, is that right?" I said, "Yeah, he thinks he might, you know, if you slow down enough, he could fall out of the car and leave the briefcase behind." "Oh," said Paul, you know, all in sort of mock seriousness. He said, "How much is in the briefcase?" I said, "How much is in the briefcase, Joe?" Joe said, "Oh, there'd be a good 10 grand there." I said, "There's a good 10 grand there, Paul." And Paul just looked at me and said, "Yeah, it's not enough, is it?" And that's how we dealt with it. We could have charged him with attempted bribery, but, you know, it just... But, yeah, that's the, you know, and I'm quite certain if Paul had wanted to slow down, Joe would have jumped out, because 10 grand to him is better than going to jail. Yeah. But it only ever happened on the vice squad, which to me was, you know, pretty typical. That's where the corruption comes from. So that's another thing why we couldn't not prosecute Carmen. You just could not let people carry on committing vice type offences without doing something about it.
So with Carmen, was it very much a kind of a cat and mouse type thing? That, I mean, you knew the game, she knew the game.
Oh, look, a lot of crime is like that. I mean, we would go around some of the nightclubs and coffee bars late at night, and Paul and I would end up playing pool with some quite well-known criminals. Me and a criminal, another criminal, Paul, and playing it. But there was always this sort of undercurrent, this undertone that they knew we were the police, and they knew that if they were going to commit crime the next day and we caught them, they were going to get locked up. This game of pool had nothing to do with it. And we knew that we were the police and they were criminals, and if they were committing crime tomorrow and got away with it, well, that was their good luck. There was this sort of gentleman's rules, shall we say, the Queensberry rules of fighting crime, Nowadays, it's a lot different. I don't think those kinds of relationship exist anymore between the police and the criminal fraternity. But yeah, and we would often meet up with, you know, with well-known criminals and, you know, have a beer in a hotel with them and then carry on. Just so that, you know, we knew they knew that we knew that they knew, sort of thing. Yeah, yeah.
How did Carmen and the rest of the girls kind of feel about police? What did they have names for you guys?
If they did, it's not... I'm just trying to think. If they did, they must have kept it to themselves because, I mean, usually the interaction we had with them, I mean, we'd pass the pleasantries of the day or the night, but that wouldn't take very long. And then we might have to interview them about some complaint or something or other. I mean, it was like when the massage parlours first came in, it was just a euphemism for a brothel. You know, we would go around there, not so much talk to the girls, but talk to the madam, the lady who was running it. And again, it was just to let them know that we knew what they were doing. And as long as they had no drugs in the place, as long as none of the customers got rolled or beaten or had their wallets taken from them, then they'd be okay to carry on in business. It was a sort of a tacit understanding between the forces of law and the forces of order. And I mean, that's all been taken care of now with the new, what are they called? Is it the Massage Parlours Act or something different? Anyway, but you know, brothels are now legal. And again, it's just another way that morality has, within my short lifetime, gone sort of a full, you know, 360 degrees. Yeah.
You were also saying that part of your work was in decent publications. Was there much gay, lesbian, transgender, indecent publications?
Not a lot, no. I'm just trying to reflect on that. Most, I would think, that 95%, possibly even higher, was your heterosexual pornography. In those days, it was, as I say, initially silent 8mm film. Then Deep Throat came out, and we had a major investigation about that because some guys imported a copy of it from America, made a negative copy of the film, which was on two big 16mm reels with soundtrack and the whole lot. And then the original went down to the Antarctic for Operation Deep Freeze. And these two guys who worked out at the National Film Unit were going to make their millions by taking copies off the negative they'd made and sell them.
So it was originally imported into New Zealand to be then shipped down to Antarctica?
Well, it was originally taken out of the continental USA to go to the Antarctic on an Operation Deep Freeze ship. And they always called into Wellington on the way. And these two guys out at the National Film Unit, how they became aware of it, I don't know. But they did, and they were able to keep the film for long enough to make a copy of it. But just going back to your original question, so heterosexual pornography, 8mm film, then that came out on a 16mm. Then the, in fact, we had so many 8mm reels of film that we got a little manually operated film editor because we just didn't have the time to run the whole thing through. And you'd put the reels on and wind them through and have a look at the picture and wind them through again. We had to do that because one or two people got clever, and particularly when VHSs came in, they would have the first few feet of the film, you know, a Walt Disney cartoon, and then it would be the pornography. So, very, very little of it from memory. Hardly any was gay. I accept gay in terms of male on male. Female on female, totally different, because that has seems to have a particular interest for a lot of guys, and females, of course. And then magazines, tons and tons of magazines. We're getting by the sackload imported from out of Europe, that sort of thing. And we'd have big, send them out to the big shredder. They had a shredder, government had a shredder out at Miramar or somewhere. But no, very, very little gay pornography in those days, very little. And now, of course, it's all pretty much legit, unless it's really serious stuff.
Deep Throat story, can you continue with that? That sounds fascinating.
Oh, okay, let me just go back very quickly. Okay, these two guys, employees of the National Film Unit, got hold of this copy of Deep Throat, made a negative copy of it, gave the original back to the sailor, and it went down to Operation Deep Freeze. With this negative, they surreptitiously, over a period of time, during their lunch hours and sneaking back at night, made a original print off the negative, one that you could actually view. So there in a little theatre in the National Film Unit out at Miramar one night, watching this first print to see what it looked like. But the manager of the National Film Unit had, of course, heard on the grapevine what was going on. He knew they were in there with a couple of their mates, so he burst in on them, grabbed the two rolls of film out of the projector, went outside, threw them in an incinerator and burnt them, went back in and said, "Now piss off because you're both fired." And he fired them on the spot. And some months went past and nothing happened. And he thought that he'd managed to quell the fire, so to speak, and that he'd kept the lid on this thing until one Friday afternoon, the Director General of the Tourist and Publicity Department, which no longer exists, which we didn't know those, and which controlled and ran the National Film Unit, the DG is in his office in town. He gets a call one Friday afternoon from the editor of Truth, who said, "Oh, look, I want you to listen to what's going to be the headline front page of next week's Truth on Tuesday," bearing in mind this is Friday. "I want you to comment on it." "Oh," says the DG, "what's the headline going to be?" "The headline is Government Department prints blue movies." "Ooh," said the DG. "Can I get back to you on that one?" Hung up and immediately rang the Commissioner of Police, because he knew nothing other than that, but that was enough to give him the willies. So at that particular day, my sergeant was away and I was the office acting in sergeant in charge of the vice squad, and I had a young detective to just assist me. So we go over to the Commissioner's office, get told to head down to the Director General of Tourism and Publicity. And he says, "Look, I've just had this phone call. Don't know what it's all about, but go out to the National Film Unit and talk to the General Manager." So we go out to the National Film Unit and talk to the General Manager, and that's when he tells us this little backstory about him burning the film, you see. So I said, "We'd better get on to this." So one of the offenders, Graham, lived out Rongotai Way. So in case he still had a film or something, he went and got a search warrant for his house, went and knocked on his door. This would be now about 8 o'clock on the Friday night. Said, "Come with us, mate. We're going to have some meaningful dialogue in the vice squad office." So he realised that he'd been caught, you see. So we get back to the vice squad office and have a lengthy interview with him, and he tells us the story. Take all that down on a statement, that's fine. So we take him downstairs to the watch house and say, "Right, you're staying here, you're not going anywhere. We've got to go and get your mate, get a search warrant for his house, and go up to Brooklyn." And it's now getting till, I suppose, or at least midnight, 1 o'clock in the morning. And this was a fellow called John, his name will come to me, John someone. Knock on the door, light goes on inside, door opens, and there's John in his pyjamas. And I say, "Hello, John. We haven't seen each other since the sixth form at Hastings Boys High School. Get your jammies off and your suit on. We're going to have some meaningful dialogue." So we go and interview him. And he tells his side of the story, which agrees with his co-offender. But what the manager of the National Film Unit hadn't realised is that when he had ripped the two reels of film out of the projector and burnt them, he thought he was destroying all the evidence. But the negative was still in existence. He didn't know about that. But we found that out by interviewing these two guys in the early hours of the Saturday morning. So we went all. I remember going out to Lower Hutt at one stage, and we eventually located this negative copy, the two reels of negative, in a suitcase under a bed out Miramar Way somewhere. So we thought, okay, that's interesting. So we wanted to prosecute these two guys with printing an indecent document, which Deep Throat was in those days. It was indecent. But the problem was the document they had printed had been destroyed. So how were we going to prove that what they destroyed was indecent? And in those days, you had to get the, and I think still in these days, to get the prosecution under the Indecent Publication Act, you had to get the Solicitor General's permission. So a file goes off the Solicitor General. And he wrote back and said, "Well, how are you going to prove that it was indecent because it's been destroyed?" And then I suddenly thought, I know how we can do that. Got the two negative copies, went back out to the National Film Unit one morning, went into the General Manager's office and said, "Remember that headline that Truth was going to publish?" He said, "Yep. Government Department makes blue movies." "Yep." I said, "Well, we're going to put that into practice." He said, "What do you mean?" I said, "Here's the negative. Make me a copy." He said, I can't do that. I said, yes, you can. And they did. And I followed this negative all through this process of making a copy, because we knew from the evidence we could produce to the court that this was the one and only negative from which a document had been printed, which was indecent, but which had been destroyed. Therefore, this copy they were now making for me was identical. So I knew it was going to be a fight. And so we had a case, and Roy Stacey defended one of these guys, and a lawyer who's now a judge of the High Court defended the other guy. So of course we have the case, and there's a few preliminary witnesses and what have you. And then I stand in the witness box, and I've got these two rolls of film that they'd made for me at the National Funeral. And I could see Roy Stacey shaking his head like this. And I'd hardly got one, you know, exhibit A, if you want to please. Hang on, Mr. Morley, we already said. So there was this huge, big argument as to whether or not we could produce this copy from the negative, which we were going to say is identical to the one that was destroyed. And there was a big legal argument over it. Big legal argument over it. And anyway, eventually the judge said, well, before I accept this as an exhibit, I think I better have a look at it. So we took one of the conference rooms at police headquarters and showed the judge the film. And he eventually agreed that, yes, on the basis of what we said to him, we could circumstantially prove that this was identical to the item that had been destroyed. And he convicted both of them. So that was a bit of an interesting landmark case, a bit like the case with Carmen and the male being a prostitute, in that here was a case, and I think it's the only time it's ever occurred in New Zealand law, here was a case where people were convicted of printing an indecent document that at the time of their conviction no longer existed. But as I say, you go down to your local corner video shop these days and you can hire Deep Throat for a dollar a night, you know, or even less. So it's again this complete change in morality just in a few short years. See, that would have been an investigation in the early 70s, I suppose, 72, 73, 83, 90, you know, not even 40 years later. Complete reversal in the laws relating to indecency. So it's a bit like that bookshop fellow and I know Don, he runs the Bookhaven in Newtown. Someone discovered that he had a book in his warehouse called Bloody Mama. This is just earlier this year, late last year, early this year, which had been declared indecent in 1962. Yet it was still indecent. And the indecent publications people came and took it off him and they reviewed it and reclassified it as no longer indecent. Because once something's declared indecent, it stays indecent. Yeah.
So there you've got indecent publications. What about indecent performance? Was that something?
Indecent performances. We'd go around the strip clubs. And again, talking about changes in morality. We would go around the strip clubs, and in those days, the strippers used to keep their panties on, if I remember correctly. And in the early days, they might have had little pasties on their nipples, but I think by the time I left the vice squad, those had been removed. Not because of anything specific. There was no law to say. It's like when the Follies Bougie used to come out here in the 1950s, some of their performers could appear naked, but they couldn't move. They had to stand stock still. So they'd almost like a statue. And the spotlight would come on them and you'd see a naked lady standing there, and then the spotlight would fade in and it'd go to another part of the stage and it'd be another lady standing there, but they couldn't move. I mean, it was almost as if by moving, they were going to be indecent. Yeah. But that had long gone by the time I got on the vice squad. So you'd have strippers at the Purple Onion and Manny Papadopoulos' Club Exotic. And the other thing, of course, was that a lot of the strippers at Carmen's were males, you see. So they could take off almost as much as they liked because their nipples were not per se indecent because they were a man's nipples.
So it was the defining thing of indecency that if you showed nipples, that was
not not necessarily. But as I say, I seem to recall that when I first went on the vice squad, most of the strippers had little pasties they stuck over their nipples because for some reason that was thought to be okay. But by the time the transition came, where they were no longer wearing pasties, It wasn't because the Commissioner of Police said, yes, you can take your pasties off now. It was some sort of subliminal, subtle kind of thought wave that went out through society that said, oh, it's okay to do that now. Most probably influenced from overseas. You know, people reading Playboy magazine and Penthouse and that sort of thing. Yes, we would call into the strip clubs and watch the girls stripping just to see what they were doing. And I remember one instance, there was a woman at Manny Papadopoulos' Club Exotic. And what did she do? She had a feather boa between her legs somehow or other. She was doing almost like she had this giant penis and she was masturbating. And we thought, that's a bit too far. That's getting into the realms of an indecent performance. So we prosecuted her and Manny and they were convicted of indecent performance. Some time later, and I can't think how long, but it couldn't have been more than perhaps 18 months to 2 years later, back at the Club Exotic, same performance. We thought, what are they doing? You know, they're mad or something? You know, get off the stage, you're coming with us. Manny, come on, mate, you're getting locked up. So we went through the whole procedure again. But the judge or the magistrate on that occasion said, no, morality has changed, detective, in the last 18 months to 2 years. No longer indecent. So it was little decisions like that gradually chipped away, and I don't mean that in a negative way, or permitted the bounds of indecency to expand so that things that were once thought indecent no longer were. I mean, you go to the strip clubs now and it's, you know, total nudity. Absolutely. So, I mean, again, there's that change. You know, the things that happen, well, not that I've been in a strip club for a long time, but things that happen in strip clubs now and some of the sex clubs in Auckland just would not have happened in those days. They'd be straight into the clink.
When somebody was convicted of an indecency like that, how would it affect them? Would it, you know, kind of ruin them? Or would
No. In fact, I think to some extent it's almost perhaps a badge of honour. It sort of showed that they were sort of prepared to push the boundaries and that sort of thing. I mean, in that particular, it wouldn't prevent them getting work anywhere, you know. Nothing like that at all. I mean, unless they suddenly wanted to go and work in a supermarket. But I mean, there was just a small group of people, strippers, who would work, you know, go between the various clubs. You'd find them dancing for Manny, and then they'd be dancing for Passy across the road, and that's all down with Carmen, and up to Auckland, and, you know, with Rankin Hastie and that sort of thing. So, amongst that that clique, I would think that would almost, you know, be a badge of honour, so to speak.
On the other side of the coin, did you have anything to do with morals campaigner Patricia Bartlett?
Well, I did, to the extent that she was one of our major complainants. But I can vividly remember going to see her out at her little flat unit out at Nainai, and she pulled this battered old suitcase out from underneath the bed to show me this terrible, terrible pornography, detective. But what it was Playboy's, Penthouse, and Health and Nature magazines. You know, I don't know if Patricia had actually ever seen any real hardcore pornography. And the organisation, what was it? The Society for the Promotion of Community Standards, that's right. I mean, well-meaning, heart's in the right place, but I think that, like a lot of pressure groups in society, they were accorded far more influence than they really should have had. So yeah, I had some dealings with her, but not a lot. Oh, and the other thing we occasionally went to, I remember we went to a play at Downstage, Equus. That had, now why did we go and see Equus? Someone complained, could well have been Patricia or one of her people. I think it was language and nudity. I think there was a nudity on the part of one of the female actresses. So Paul and I went and sat in the audience and watched this play and put in a report and said, we can't see anything wrong with it. And that was it. So it was pretty much, something like that was pretty much left to our judgment. You know, we could have said, yeah, it's terrible, shocking, you know, naked women. But I think from the point of view of the nudity, I think it was because there was a nudity in a theatre as opposed to nudity in a strip club where you would expect it. And I think this might have been one of the first plays in a straight theatre, a genuine theatre, involving nudity, particularly female. It might have even been male nudity. I just forget now. Nudity somewhere anyway, but it, from memory, it was nothing to, you know, to be bothered with.
So you were on the Vice Squad for how many years?
Oh, look, I should have got all my... I've got all my notebooks out and had a look. I left in 77. In 77, I was on the car squad when I left. I'd gone to car squad from there, so 6, 5, 4, 3... I think at least a good 6 years.
Why did you leave?
The police. Oh, it was time for a change. I'd been in the police for 17 years. And I just felt that it was time to, you know, do something different. Yeah.
Do you have any reflections on your time in the Vice Squad and what we've been talking about over the last hour?
Well, to me it was just another aspect of police work, albeit very interesting. I'd often said, I often say to this day, if they'd left me on the Vice Squad, I'd still, you know, be in the police. Because I just found it very interesting and fascinating work. The people that you met, that sort of thing. But the only reflections are, yeah, interesting, great people, very interesting cases. I mean, that Deep Throat case, the case with Carmen, those sorts of cases were very interesting that you wouldn't get involved in other than being on the Vice Squad. And as long as you keep your nose clean and rebuff any attempts to corrupt you, I could have still been there. I wouldn't have been married any longer, because it was not... So what would happen is I'd go to work about 2 o'clock of an afternoon. Wife's at work, kids are at school. Go to work, check some paperwork, make some phone calls, da-da-da, and then Paul and I would get in a car and go into town somewhere for a meal, for dinner. And then we'd start going around the clubs and the pubs and what have you, and most probably get home, if we started work at 2, sometime close to midnight. Right, wife's asleep, kids are asleep. I get into bed. 6 hours later, wife gets up, kids get up, wife goes to work, kids go to work. I wake up about 10 o'clock in the morning, house is empty. We're living in the same house but not seeing each other. So certainly, a lot of, not just saying Vice Squad work and certainly not just saying police work, any shift work can be very debilitating to good relationships. But no, I enjoyed it, and as I say, fascinating people, and